Adam and Eve ate of the apple and learned the difference between right and wrong. There was a social worker in the group who said, social work began that. It began before that. Social work began when Eve shared her apple with underprivileged Adam. And then the physician remembered, yes, but my profession began even earlier than that. My profession began when, through surgery, God made Eve, lifted her out of Adam's rib. And an engineer thought, according to scripture, my occupation comes even earlier than that. Because you will remember that scripture says that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth out of chaos. And then there was an economist in the group. He said, my occupation began even earlier than that. Who created the chaos? Well, economics is a lot less chaotic now than it used to be, at least the ethical aspects of some of the businessmen's work, Paul. Carol Hinderly asked me to spend one session on church occupations. And I'd like to say a few things about church occupations. I'm not sure that I can stay awake through my lecture this morning. But I'd like to say a few things about church occupations as we deal with them now or have been thinking about them in the LCA. And as I had an interesting opportunity to encounter another point of view among particularly some European theologians and African teachers in Jerusalem a couple months ago. I suppose that there are a couple assumptions with which one must begin in talking about church occupations. And one of these is that in terms of the doctrine of the priesthood of all believers, the vocation of every Christian is the same. That is, we are not called to the ministry which is better than teaching, which is better than social work, which is better than carpentry, and so forth in a hierarchy. We are all called to follow Christ in whatever occupation we happen to be skilled and engaged. Matter of fact, our board in LCA is called the Board of College Education and Church Vocations, and we strenuously object to the label church vocations because the calling that we have is the same, but the occupations in which we engage are quite different. A second assumption from which we have started is that there is no greater merit in one ministry than in other ministries. That is, the ministry of the musician, the ministry of the ditch digger, the ministry of the teacher, the ministry of the parent, the ministry of the ordained men are not differentiated in the sight of God on the basis of some hierarchy of merit. And this implies, next, that there's no particular merit in working for the church. And in a way, taking that position is somewhat devastating to our responsibility to go find people to serve the church as an institution. Nevertheless, we must assume that every Christian serves the church. and that this is the nature of being a Christian, the nature of being called. I was in an interesting situation with a group of people who were talking about the manner of Christian vocation in relationship to education. And since this is the field in which I have spent my years, I had an opportunity to sit with these people from various other parts of the Lutheran Church in the world, and to listen to a position of what it means to be a Christian teacher in a school, which really surprised me, because I didn't think that this position was any longer being taken, but it was. And I'd like to say a few words about that for two reasons. One, I prepared some materials on it. And secondly, I think it'll be illustrative of the things that I want to say. When I hear descriptions of what the Christian teacher is like, I discover characteristics that I'd want in whatever teacher I would hire, whether he be Christian, Jewish, Hindu, or whatever. For example, in the discussions which we held among these various Lutherans, one of the characteristics of the Christian teacher which was cited was that the person be intelligent. And I got kind of the impression that whether he was a Christian or not, he wouldn't have much skill at teaching if he didn't have intelligence. Another point was made that he ought to be ethical and stand for the ethical and intellectual values, decency, justice, goodwill, freedom, objectivity, and all the rest. I'd really hate to hire any teacher in my school to work with my kids who didn't have these same characteristics, regardless of religious or irreligious convictions. What a travesty if a school faculty had license to teach falsehood rather than truth, selfishness rather than generosity, dishonesty above justice, hostility before brotherhood. What a tragedy if the teacher had leave to induce his students to cherish triviality and be contemptuous of humane values. If such a school existed, I think we would call it evil regardless of who manned it, and we would seek to cleanse or close it. Again, I hear every teacher should love children. And while this is, I think, a considerably finer point, I don't think I could trust my children with a teacher whose interest in children is merely professional. I think love must be genuine, or it is not love, but a brittle and even shrewd self-interest. And I think a child senses very quickly whether or not the adults in his world really like him. And then out of that feeling of the adult for the child ensues a relationship which fosters or hinders the child's progress. Without love, he cannot feel secure, wanted, or respected. But in order to learn, he must possess these inner receptors. At this point, I think the Christian teacher has a special advantage, and I was interested, Paul, in your description of the Christian businessman as a man who is fully human in the first place, but has a resource with which to become human. And perhaps this could be applied to any profession. I would anticipate it could be applied very easily to teachers. I would want a teacher to be a fully loving person in his or her relationships to those with whom he or she works. But Christianity provides a special advantage, a special resource to the teacher in this respect, because the Christian is committed to the God with whom the quality of love is greater even than the quality of faith. So the Christian teacher has an inexhaustible resource from which to draw in giving love or responding lovingly to children. And this capacity for receiving and giving love may turn out to be the teacher's best witness of the presence and power of God in him. I'd like to make one little observation here about the test of whether or not a teacher has such a resource. I think it comes more than any other time when no gratitude or other response is given in return. I think the nature of the Christian shows up when he is able to give regardless of the preliminary attitudes or the direct personal responses of those with whom he works. That a teacher's pupils love her in return is secondary. If it becomes primary, her usefulness as a teacher is limited. In other words, the test of the Christian teacher sometimes lies in those common situations where the natural man would quit helping children for lack of response or would retaliate against youth for misbehaving or doing evil and the like. Christians can learn a great deal about this, I think, from the wise mother in Lorraine Hansberry's play A Raisin in the Sun. Mama's son misuses and loses the family capital entrusted to him, and then compounds his wrong by planning a despicable means of recouping his loss elsewhere. And his sister, Benita, proceeds to give up on him. And Benita says, "He's no brother of mine." And Mama looks quizzically, says, "What do you say?" "I said that that individual in that room is no brother of mine." "That's what I thought you said. You feeling like you better than he is today? What you tell him a minute ago? That he wasn't a man? Yes? You give him up for me. You done wrote his epitaph too, like the rest of the world. Well, who give you the privilege?" And Benita pleads with Mother, "Be on my side for once. You saw what he just did, Mama. Wasn't it you who taught me to despise any man who would do that, do what he's going to do?" "Yes," said Mama, "I taught you that, me and your daddy. But I thought I taught you something else, too. I thought I taught you to love him." "Love him? Well, there's nothing left to love." "There is always something left to love," says Mama. "And if you ain't learned that, you ain't learned nothing. Have you cried for that boy today? I don't mean for yourself and for the family because we lost the money. I mean for him, what he'd been through and what it done to him. Child, when do you think is the time to love somebody the most? When they done good and made things easy for everybody? Well, then you ain't through learning, because that ain't the time at all. It's when he's at his lowest and can't believe in himself because the world done whipped him so. When you start measuring somebody, measure him right, child. Measure him right. Make sure you done taken into account what hills and valleys he come through before he got to wherever he is." With respect to the process of becoming, the concept which Allport makes the text of the book to which I've called your attention in the first day, and a concept, interestingly, to which you called attention today, Paul. It seems to me that one of the most useful things to know about self and others is the hills and valleys we come through before we got to wherever we is today. And I suspect that guiding youngsters through those hills and valleys is part of the process that equips the businessman or anybody else with the capacity to look at the current situation in a particular at the present time and respond to it ethically. You come through certain hills and valleys and you arrive at the situation without the capacity to discern what is the ethical thing in the present situation. You come through other hills and valleys and you arrive in the present with a moderate capacity to discern. And you go through other hills and valleys and you arrive at the present with a keen insight into what is the ethical situation. And I think we know something about what are the hills and valleys through which a person needs to come in order to arrive at a well-developed conscience, a keen sensitivity, and the like. And this was part of the text of our 2 weeks of work. Well, at any rate, when you look at Mama and Benita, you know that here is God at work in contemporary lives. No matter whether Mama uses the time-worn cliches of religious men, God chooses his vessel, and it is our task to find him at work and thank and worship him for the good that is wrought and for the abortion of evil. Here in Mama is a manifestation of love from which I think any Christian can learn his proper role in response to many of the irritations, the disobedience, and the plain evil which sometimes confronts us in children and youth. I had opportunity the other day to speak of imperfect love. One of the things that it seems to me we have opportunity to do as Christians is to analyze rather carefully the nature of this thing called love, because love comes in many forms, and not all of them lead to the fullness of humanity that you want in the businessman and that I would hope we would find regardless of our occupation. And one of the points that I'd like to repeat is the recognition that because love comes in many forms, love is not necessarily wise. Love is not enough is another way of saying it when you think of some of the kinds of love which one is capable of receiving or giving because they are imperfect. And it seems to me that perfect love includes understanding. This means, for example, in the field of education, that I think the teacher is able to give and receive love wisely only if he knows enough about self and about the child with whom he works. I think there's a very close relationship between understanding and the love of which I speak. I used to have an interesting time working with a juvenile court judge in helping give him the background of some of the factors that led juvenile delinquents who are coming up in his court, helping him understand some of the background factors that made the youngster as he was. And I have seen feelings of downright disgust and hostility toward a youth melt into warmth and affection for him when he was sufficiently understood. Most psychological advisors to juvenile judges could, I think, substantiate the experience I have had of observing gradual erosion in a judge's punitive attitude toward a delinquent as he got more and more of the facts about the youth and the forces which shaped his current thoughts, attitudes, and delinquent behavior. I think there's a great deal of truth in the French proverb that to know all is to forgive all. And I suspect there is a close relationship between the omniscience of God and the forgiving characteristic of God. Another of the characteristics of the Christian teacher that I heard extolled among this group of people to whom I refer is that the teacher is concerned with the whole person in any occupation, I suppose, or any service occupation at any rate, this might be so. An African educator said, for example, proper education must aim at serving the child who is not a means to an end, but an end in himself. And I think that's well said. And I think the point has numerous implications. And I think sometimes we fail in our relationships to other human beings at this point because in relationship to a child, for example, we minister not to the child himself, but to the man he will become. I think oftentimes we are too much future-oriented in our relationships to other people. We can be trapped by the illusion in school, for example, that every subject or skill which will be useful to the man should be acquired by the child and should be interesting to the child because of its future utility. But that isn't so. It's a rare child who will take a promissory note on the future at face value. I think with respect to children, it is meet, right, and salutary for a child to live as a child and to learn as a child. And I am pretty sure, on the basis of clinical evidence, that a growing person's manhood will be delayed and his youth robbed by teaching him as if he were already a man. We have said some things about individuality and individual differences. One of the things that impresses me about the teachings of Jesus is that in both his words and his actions, he emphasized that the individual person is supremely worthwhile. Every situation is unique. Every person is unique. Every combination of the two, therefore, becomes unique. But educationally, this means that children and youth are individuals with individual potentialities, limitations, and interests. The bulk of people are not an amorphous mass that can be run through a standardized, undifferentiated program like metal down a mass production line of shapers, cutters, pressers, and welders. We might go back to the statement we made the other day that the basic ideological conflict of our century is between the idea that the individual is supremely important and the idea that he's significant only as a spoke in the wheel of the state, tribe, or peer group. And in this conflict, I think there is no question as to the side on which the Christian commits himself. As a matter of fact, I think the Christian has a responsibility, a special responsibility, in all relationships with human beings to see to it that communities are so built that they respect individuality and that the schools, for example, tailor learning experiences accordingly. Some of you are teachers of handicapped children. I've been rather interested in this because it seems to me that in the schools of our country, you get a prototype of what an outstanding service to children through education can be if you look at what is happening in many of the special education programs that the public schools provide. For special education does some interesting things that are oftentimes neglected in other classrooms. Special education insists upon good diagnosis of the child's assets, his liabilities, his interpretations of reality, his adjustment techniques, his springs of action, and other characteristics before prescribing appropriate learning experiences. And then it provides specific education addressed to the specific problems and the specific possibilities of the unique child. For example, the child who can't form an R, L, or a consonant blend gets specific speech correction aimed at this, not just general speech development. The child who can't see 10 or 12 point type gets clear type books, worksheets, tests, and so forth. The child with a limited attention span gets more constant direction. The child who is slow to form concepts gets patient guidance through many experiences until the idea of red or subtract or patriotism emerges.
The child who can't understand symbols gets multitudinous experiences with concrete objects and pictures. The child who is angry half the days he arrives at school gets cathartic assistance to begin with and help in learning new adjustment techniques. Incidentally, work with special education, one of the things that always interested me was that it was possible to get teachers to emphasize not diagnosis of what the child is alone, but also prognosis. In other words, the emphasis was not so much on what are his handicaps, but what are his potentialities. And this orientation has an enormous impact upon one's relationships to other human beings, and specifically in this case, the teacher's relationship to children, whether it be in Sunday school, regular school, college, or wheresoever. Goethe once pointed out that if you treat an individual as he is, he will stay as he is. But if you treat him as if he were what he ought to be and could be, he will become what he ought to be and could be. And I don't think this is a Pollyannistic approach, which assumes that a child can do anything if he but tries. It's simply an emphasis upon potentialities within a realistic recognition of limitations. I find this kind of teaching going on particularly in the elementary grades, especially the primary grades of the schools that I have seen in operation. I see less and less of it going on as one gets farther and farther up the educational scale. Fortunately, less and less teaching needs to be done the farther one gets up the scale, and more one can depend upon the individual independent learner to do his own learning. A number of additional points I think might be made here. Let me skip to the proposition that I heard made by one of the educators to the effect that the whole man, body, mind, and soul must receive the most careful attention of the Christian teacher. Now, I think this concept of dealing with the whole person in one's relationships to them, whether it's a teaching relationship or a friendly relationship or whatever, is very, very important. In teaching, of course, this is especially important in a day when I think there's a real temptation for teachers to think of students as disembodied minds to be honed sharp. We certainly can't forget that that students are persons. In the United States, as a matter of fact, we often refer to the classic example of the teacher as that of a great Christian of the 19th century, Mark Hopkins, and the ideal school as one which is said to have consisted of Mark Hopkins on one end of a log, teaching a promising youth at the other end, in this case, the future president of the United States, James Garfield, discussing with him every phrase of his development, every phase of his development, from the parsing of Greek verbs to the salvation of his eternal soul. One of the factors in the learning of other people that I think is exceptionally important to keep in mind in this respect is the point that we made the other day to the effect that human beings are built to feel as well as think. The recognition that every human thought is immersed in a sea of feeling, and that you cannot approach people on a purely rational level. Sometimes a sea of feeling is placid and sometimes it is stormy. We've called attention to the fact that moderate positive feelings promote mental efficiency, and one will never get people to work at their optimum intellectually without the stimulation of moderate warm feelings. And obviously, negative feelings increase tension, and strong negative feelings simply disrupt thought. And one of the most important factors in Working with a human being at any age, therefore, becomes this factor of freeing the person to think and to learn. I think every day we come across situations in which the essential question is this person bound by worry, fear, hostility, guilt, and the like, or is he free to think with me? Is he free to learn? This is certainly a crucial element in classroom work. And I think freedom to learn is as important as any freedom a human being can possess. And yet there is pretty fair evidence that at least one child out of every six in every classroom does not have this freedom. And as a consequence, does not begin to fulfill his potentialities because he is not free to acquire even such basic things as the ability to read. By the way, feelings, I think, help us to explain the gap between what a child knows is best to do and what he actually does. Wasn't it Shakespeare who said, if to do were as easy as to know what were good to do, chapels had been churches and poor men's cottages, princes' palaces. It is a good divine who follows his own teaching. I think maybe he was thinking of the kind of preacher who is said to be so heavenly that he's of no earthly good. In terms of the teacher, at any rate, it seems to me that the teacher can never ignore a child's feelings if he would free the child to learn and guide him to maturity. And consequently, it would be helpful for all of us in the teaching roles that we all play in relationship to other people. The teaching roles that we play in our offices, the teaching roles we play in our families, the teaching roles we play in our professions, the teaching roles we play from the pulpit, within the Sunday school class, and so forth. I think it would be helpful for us to learn all we can about nourishing healthy emotional development, about vaccinating children against the corrosive effects of some emotions, and about emotional first aid. Now, we got into a real interesting controversy about one point that I'd like to, explore in some detail. And this was this question of the witness of the Christian teacher then, the verbal witness of the Christian teacher in the classroom. Let me describe what astonished me as the point of view of one Christian who is a teacher in one of our schools in Tanzania. He described the teacher, essentially a Christian teacher, as both a servant of the state and a preacher of the word. And as a preacher, he said his main task is to bring up the children put under his care in proper understanding of God's creation. It is his main task also to show the children the way of salvation. And I almost dropped. He said that one of the main objectives of this teacher-preacher is to win youth for Christ. He said, even though the Christian teacher, like any other teacher, must be very much concerned with the task of imparting formal secular education to those under his care, he must at the same time not lose sight of the other great objective of winning our young people to the Christian faith. Furthermore, he said, I see no reason why religious education, where possible, should not assist boys and girls to become Christian members in the Christian church. After I gave my speech in reaction to his, he was sick for a day. But I had a real interesting experience discovering that it was possible for him to face reality before the week was out and to recognize that he's living in the kind of world in which he cannot be this kind of person in a classroom any longer. And to an American, this seems fantastic that one should assume this particular position. But particularly among the mission schools, I think this is still a viable conception. Let me read a little bit more of what this conception is. The Christian teacher is to achieve his objective of spreading the gospel not only through his preaching of the word in the classroom, but especially through the way he performs his work. That sounds good. He must conduct himself in the best Christian tradition. He must express his faith in his social living and social service. But his teaching is not to be objective. It is to be frankly slanted. In the classroom, the Christian teacher will approach each field of knowledge from the Christian point of view. In every subject, it would be possible for the Christian teacher to show how God is at work there. At the very center of all studies must be the saving message of Christ. Christ should be presented to the children as an eternal savior of mankind and not as a great philosopher or a great social worker. This particular teacher also strove toward his objective by cultivating a Christian fellowship in the school. He said the teacher should do his best to make his pupils learn and know the Christian way of life and even try to create a Christian community at school. The Christian school must show a good example of Christian fellowship, Christian worship. Christian worship must be at the heart of the school life. I was encouraged by the fact that at two points he had some reservations. One was at the point of indoctrination and the other was at the point of proselytization. I'd like to point out that if the church is free to use schools, even its own, as agencies of indoctrination or propaganda, even the propaganda of the faith, then the state must be given the same right. And if the state uses its schools for doctrinaire purposes, we are really in a rough situation because citizens don't have the option of not attending and not supporting them as they have with respect to the church's schools. And thus freedom can easily be lost and the individual child can become the pawn in the hands of his rulers as he has been in at least two notable school systems of the recent and contemporary world. I'd like to suggest, therefore, that it is most satisfactory and constructive for the schools to be objective with respect to religion. I don't think objectivity precludes evangelism by the Christian teacher, and I'd like to return to that point. But it does imply certain ground rules with respect to the role of the teacher and the nature of the work that the teacher does. For example, and I think I want to say this particular, speak this particular material here because I think you people are going to have much to say about the nature of the public schools and the communities in which you are going to live the rest of your lives, the communities in which your children will be reared, the communities in which the other children who will form the community of the future will be reared, and there is much going on at this particular point in these schools. An objective position requires that religion be taught in state-supported schools as well as church-supported ones. Since it is impossible to understand people without knowing their beliefs and the influence of those beliefs upon their actions, it is inconceivable that an adequate education in psychology, sociology, history, and so forth can be divested of religious references. This position is expressed as follows by the National Council of Churches of Christ in a 1963 policy statement called The Churches and the Public Schools. No person is truly educated for life in the modern world who is not aware of the vital part played by religion in the shaping of our history and culture and of its contemporary expressions. Information about religion is an essential part of many school subjects such as social studies, literature, and the arts. The contributions of religious leaders, movements, ideas should be treated objectively and broadly in any presentation of these subjects. Public school administrators and textbook producers are to be commended for the progress made to date in including objective information about religion in various subject matter fields. And by the way, the Association of School Administrators in the United States has just published a little booklet on their position with respect to religion in the public schools. It arises out of the Supreme Court decision rejecting imposed prayer and inviting the teaching of religion in the public schools, a statement which parallels pretty much the position that many have taken through the National Council of Churches. The full treatment of some regular school subjects requires the use of the Bible as a source book. In such studies, including those related to character development, the use of the Bible has a valid educational purpose. So has the Quran. So have a number of the other religious source books. But neither true religion nor good education is dependent upon the devotional use of the Bible in the public school program. The key lies in the manner or attitude with which school personnel approach religious content. And this can be a matter of delicate balance. In the United States, for example, I think the striving toward objectivity has often produced freedom to propagate irreligious attitudes while avoiding religious ones. Neither objectivity nor neutralism are served by avoiding religious education. To avoid such content is to extirpate a whole area of human concern and experience from an adequate educational program, and I submit that this is tantamount to espousing an anti-religious stand. And I think, therefore, one of our major objectives ought to be pressed for the teaching of comparative or historical religion in the public schools. The only objective position, then, in my judgment, in both state and church schools, is to teach for religious literacy just as one teaches for historical, geographical, scientific, and musical literacy. I think there are certain ways in which this can be done more effectively than others. But I think there are some implications in this. I think the content must be much broader than the nature of Christianity or any other one religion. In December, for example, I think the child in the American public schools should read, sing, do projects, and so forth, not only to learn the meaning of Christ's birth to Christians, but also to learn the meaning of Hanukkah to Jews. There are innumerable opportunities to compare Christian interpretations of history with the interpretations of Spengler, Marx, Toynbee, and others. I don't think Christians need fear how their position will come out in comparison with others. If they do need to fear, then their position needs revision. I think it should also be observed that one's religious views cannot be fully understood, nor do I think his faith can be adequately tested until both are contrasted and compared with the views and faiths of others. Now, let me turn for a few minutes to the evangelistic role of the teacher. As Lutherans, we hold an evangelical faith to which we must witness. How do we reconcile this fact with what has just been said about objectivity? The answer, I think, doesn't lie in our response to the question, should I witness, but in response to the question, how should I witness? Now, it's possible that the mission school picture that I described from one of the teachers in the mission school will work in some places at certain times, but I don't think it's any longer possible in a pluralistic culture, and most cultures in this world are rapidly moving toward the pluralistic pattern that is characterizing the United that is characteristic of the United States. So let me briefly describe two alternative methods of evangelism or witness that have been widely discussed. The first one I feel very warmly toward. The second one is something new to me and to others. I don't know exactly what to think about it, but it has some attractive elements in it. The first one was most clearly expressed by the World Student Christian Federation in its July 1964 statement called "The Christian Community in the Academic World." These were college and university students speaking about what their role as evangelists on the campus is. Here the students call attention to the problems created for them in the academic world by the connotations of the words evangelization, witness, and mission. These words, they say, carry the historical burden of implying speaking before listening, calling people away from their natural communities into an isolated or separated Christian grouping, and preoccupation with the soul at the expense of the whole of life. They add, even when the words witness and mission are properly understood, many students feel that they are too big and too definite. They suggest a certainty of faith and purpose and an ability to conceptualize faith in terms which create difficulty for many people, not least for those most committed to Christ and his gospel. So the students chose the word presence to indicate their evangelistic role in the academic community. It does not mean that we are simply there, they said. It tries to describe the adventure of being there in the name of Christ, often anonymously, listening before we speak, hoping that men will recognize Jesus for what he is and stay where they are, involved in the fierce fight against all that dehumanizes, ready to act against demonic powers, to identify with the outcast, merciless in ridiculing modern idols and myths. When we say presence, we say that we have to get into the midst of things even when they frighten us. Once we are there, we may witness fearlessly to Christ if the occasion is given. We may also have to be silent. In one sense of the word, presence precedes witness. In another sense, the very presence is witness. To the Christian, I think this method of evangelism emphasizes first that it is important to have a Christian in as many key spots around this world as possible. In as many school faculties, for example, as possible. His presence is a proclamation of the word insofar as the Spirit of Christ shines through him. He feels no compulsion to preach. He gives no formal attention to religious instruction, but he is there, and yet not merely there. The Holy Spirit abides in him and works through the way he speaks, the way he behaves, the way he enjoys life, the truths he teaches. And when called upon to take a stand, he does so and acknowledges its source. Now, the other method of evangelism is being developed theologically today in response to the increasing secularization of society and the suspicion that the day of metaphysical religion is gone. You remember that Bonhoeffer observed, we are proceeding toward a time of no religion at all. Therefore, he asked, how do we speak about God without religion? How do we speak in a secular fashion of God? Harvey Cox, who has just moved from Andover Newton to Harvard, has attempted to answer Bonhoeffer's questions in a recent book that if you haven't read, you'd find it a stimulating thing at any rate, called The Secular City. The Secular City. Cox says, speaking about God in a secular fashion requires, first of all, that we place ourselves at those points where the restoring, reconciling activity of God is occurring, where the proper relationship between man and man is appearing. This means that evangelism, the speaking about God, is political. And the French theologian Philip Marie is right when he says that politics may be the language of evangelism. Standing in a picket line is a way of speaking. By doing it, a Christian speaks of God. He helps alter the word God by changing the society in which it has been trivialized, by moving away from the context where God talk usually occurs, and by shedding the stereotyped roles in which God's name is usually intoned. We speak of God politically, says Cox, whenever we give occasion to our neighbor to become the responsible adult agent, the fully post-town and post-tribal man which God expects him to be today. We speak to him of God whenever we cause him to realize consciously the web of interhuman reciprocity in which he is brought into being and sustained as a man. We speak to him of God whenever our words cause him to shed some of the blindness and prejudice of immaturity, and to accept a larger and freer role in fashioning the instrumentalities of human justice and cultural vision. We do not speak to him of God by trying to make him religious, but, on the contrary, by encouraging him to come fully of age, putting away childish things. The Swiss theologian Gerhard Ebeling, though he does not use the term political, means something similar when he talks about the non-religious. In short, worldly talk of God is godly talk of the world. Now, Christians who take this position say, among other things, first, that it is not necessary to speak of God and Christ in conventional terms. As a matter of fact, they say Christ's work is not necessarily done by those who use the conventional labels. Not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do the will of my heavenly Father. Second, they say that Christ's work may be apprehended and accomplished by those who are nominally non-Christian. Kathleen Bliss, for example, points out in a recent book published by our publishing house, a book about the laity, We the People, that the work of a manager in industry or of a trade union official, or any person holding responsibility for the ordering of relationships, may do much to remove the occasions of bitterness, strife, anger, and panic. If this were being done by Christians, we should regard it as a work of Christ. But we ought to be able to say that we recognize it as Christ's work, no matter what the personal beliefs of the agents. Third, the adherents of this position claim that God reveals himself only in relationships between a man and his fellow men. It is in the large or small actions of kindness, competence, promptness, restraint, and the like that Christ is at work, making it possible for men to live, learn, and work together. From this point of view, the witnessing Christian teacher is the one who, while abjuring the language of evangelism, finds his joy in doing a common task with God by teaching objectively and skillfully, by respecting individuality, by loving each child wisely, by treating him as a whole person, and by fostering the highest human values. For this reason, I feel that the institutionalized church can assist all of us in fulfilling our Christian vocation, wherever we are, by helping us to face the significant theological issues that are involved in statements like this, and the complex psychological problems which have theological elements, like the nature of love and its distorted manifestations. And at this particular point, it seems to me that the church can use its theologically trained men in an exceptionally helpful way to the rest of us to analyze the factors involved and develop ways of dealing with them. And this, I hope, will be the happy outcome of some of the work that has been initiated and is going on in many of the training programs of the church today.